the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and from the Gruber Family Foundation for support of NPR's international coverage.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. WILL programs are made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, whose Millercom Lecture Series presents The View from the Street, Attitudes Towards Politics and Religion Among Ordinary Citizens in the Arab World, by Mark Tesler, on Thursday, October 2nd at 7:30 p.m. at Knight Auditorium in the Spurlock Museum, online at www.cas.uiuc.edu.
It's 1:06 on the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Tom Rogers, in for Celeste Quinn. We go to the archives for this hour's interview segment from back in July. As this is a pre-recorded program, no phone calls, please.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. It was very early one morning when it dawned on Dade Hayes that his six-month-old daughter, Margo, was hooked on television. He says attempting to turn the TV off became an ordeal that produced tears and screams. There are lots of parents and children in this same boat. The Kaiser Family Foundation reported in 2006 that 42% of children begin watching before they turn one, 36% have TV sets in their own room, and 52% of children under the age of three know how to operate the remote control. On the program today, we're going to take a look at the universe of children's entertainment, TV shows, DVDs, and more. Our guest is Dade Hayes. He's a journalist whose beat is the entertainment business, and he and his wife are the parents of two young children now, Margo and Finley. Dade Hayes is also the author of Anytime Playdate, Inside the Preschool Entertainment Boom, or How Television Became My Baby's Best Friend. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Dade Hayes. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Dade Hayes, our guest, is the assistant managing editor at Variety. He is the co-author with Jonathan Bing of Open Wide, How Hollywood Box Office Became a National Obsession. In addition to his work for Variety, he's written for TV Guide, Premiere, and Entertainment Weekly. His new book, Anytime Playdate, Inside the Preschool Entertainment Boomer, How Television Became My Baby's Best Friend, is published by the Free Press. Again, the phone numbers 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Dade Hayes, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good afternoon. It's my pleasure to be with you.
So, what's your approach today to what media your children are allowed?
Well, you know, it's interesting. My wife and I were just talking the other day about how, kind of without any explicit agreement between us or any effort consciously on either of our parts, our son is watching a lot less of the content that's deliberately, you know, aimed at him. That would be the baby videos like Baby Einstein or any of the other programming that, as I freely acknowledge in the book, I did put in front of my daughter when she was quite young. My son is about 16 months old. And, you know, as any parent with multiple children will tell you, there's a lot of the spillover effect where he'll wander in and out of the room as his older sister is watching something. And so, you know, he's not, completely sort of distanced from television. But we have changed in the sense that, you know, if it's 6:30 in the morning when he's up, we don't think of the TV the way we once did, or we don't think of DVDs or any of the rest of it. We've tried to sort of, you know, take it very slow.
Yeah. Well, how did you go about weaning Margo from the tube and then setting up appropriate watching rules? Or I don't know if you have rules.
Yeah. I mean, we try the yardstick for us is about an hour a day, and that's usually broken up into, you know, now she's a lot more active and, you know, kind of more socialized, which is what happens with little kids. They go to, you know, right now she's in, you know, day camp. You know, she's been attending preschool. And so that, you know, blessedly sort of, you know, creates its own routine and kind of creates some boundaries as far as, you know, when it's okay or not okay to watch TV. So it tends to be a little bit in the morning and maybe a little bit in the afternoon, but we really try to make it no more than an hour.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, you know, as to how we changed it, I mean, it's, you know, nothing is ever perfect. I think any parent will say it's, you know, whether you're talking about dietary issues or behavioral traits. I mean, you know, nothing changes overnight, and nothing changes, you know, in a textbook fashion. So it's been a long-term process, but you know, I think she's become aware. And one of my messages in the book is that, you know, she's, you know, our daughter's become aware of the fact that there are some quality shows and some not so high quality shows, and technology such as DVR and DVD, it allows you to find that quality. And so that's something that we've really tried to emphasize with her.
How old is she?
She's going to be 5 in about a week.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, what are her favorites?
Well, she loves, there's a PBS show called Super Why.
Yeah.
It's one of her favorites. And I happen to know the story of it, and I have a little passage in the book about it because it was created by the folks behind Blue's Clues. So that, you know, kind of tells you something about the pedigree. She also likes Pinky Dinky Doo. That's another favorite. similar kind of show in that it's kind of a what they call pre-literacy. It's trying to get, you know, kids before they're maybe actually reading in big chunks, you know, just familiar with the idea of, you know, processing text and sort of getting excited about the notion of reading. And so those are a couple favorites. She, you know, she also watches, let's see, Little Einsteins, you know, Curious George, Backyardigans. I mean, she's, you know, sort of it depends on the month. It really does change. That's one interesting observation that I've had as well, is that her tastes continually change. You know, I have a whole chapter in the book about Dora the Explorer,
mm-hmm.
this vastly popular and lucrative character in the Nickelodeon universe. And, you know, for months and months and months, it was just, she was the guiding light for my daughter. And now, you know, without much ceremony, she sort of switched gears. And it's not that she dislikes Dora, but she just, you know, rarely watches anymore.
Yeah.
So.
Well, let's talk about these two of these programs that you mentioned a little bit, Dora the Explorer and Super Why. Super Why is a PBS program that's aimed at kids from ages 3 to 6, and it's teaching reading skills is the idea. And you write about the program and its development and one of the developers, Alice Wilder, in the book. Can you give us a little bit of some understanding of how a program like Super Why is developed?
Well, that's a very interesting show because I think it speaks to the current climate in terms of you know, government funding for public broadcasting, and you know that's not exactly my forte in terms of, you know, really analyzing all the policy aspects of that.
Uh-huh.
But as it pertains to children's entertainment, there's tended to be more of an emphasis on sort of hard curriculum, you know, science, for example. There's a show called Peep in the Big Wide World that some of your listeners may know on Discovery. That's for preschoolers as well. And Curious George, you know, which is another PBS kids show, has a math component. So they kind of tend to integrate, you know, these these core curricular concepts into their shows in order to qualify for grant money or for funding. So sometimes that can be a complication that doesn't result in a you know, fluid show that's enjoyable to watch. But in the case of Super Why, I have to say, it is really the opposite. I think they actually had the initial thought about the show and the construction of the show, and then they went about seeing where they could get it made and how to get it funded. And that's usually where you have success, where you're not just slapping some extra layer on top of any existing show. But basically, just a quick snapshot of the show. I mean, it's these average kids who are transformed into superheroes through their as part of their quest to solve a given problem in an episode, and they look to books to actually unlock the knowledge that will help them solve certain problems. And it's a computer animated show, and it's really, it has things on its mind that it's trying to teach, but at the same time, it's actually very fun and brightly colored, and just it's a sweet show. I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's got a lot of music. It reminds me, I haven't seen the show, but I've heard the music. It reminds me a little bit of Schoolhouse Rock.
Yes, yeah, there's kind of that accessible... I don't know how you'd quite describe it. It's sort of, there's a kind of a can-do spirit about it, which sounds awfully corny. But I think for little kids, it's an important sort of note to hit. And it doesn't seem, while of course they are doing the usual, merchandising and so forth, it doesn't immediately scream out, that it's basically like a toy commercial, as so many of the other shows seem to be.
Well, irony comes along soon enough, right?
Right.
Well, now let's talk about Dora the Explorer. This is responsible, this show is responsible for just the huge success of Nickelodeon.
Absolutely. I mean, I just found her to be fascinating. I mean, the more I dug into the story of her creation and the ways that she, keeps bringing in money for Nickelodeon. It is an extraordinary story. She right now is valued at about $1.7 billion a year in revenue. And, because of all the licensing that they're able to do, it's hundreds of consumer products that bear, her likeness that kind of drive the whole enterprise. The show itself, I will say, has held up pretty well in terms of research that's been done on not just the bilingual piece, which I think gets a lot of attention. She is sprinkling Spanish phrases into the show, and that's kind of a nice, I guess, chicken soup, aspect of the show. Not it hasn't been shown to be totally transformative in a lot of the studies that have been done, but it's more the fact that she's this 7-year-old girl, going on these heroic quests and leading and asserting herself and solving problems, and that's a very powerful image, not to mention the fact that she's Latino, which is did not initially start out as the plan. I mean, she was a little red-haired, freckled Irish girl and transformed over time into what she is today.
Yeah, and now we have what's been described as a Chinese Dora.
Yes. I early on decided in my book that I needed to follow the story of a show's creation and really kind of delve into how they balanced, the educational mission with the imperatives of the marketplace and entertaining kids and engaging them in a way that can be monetized. And I thought Nickelodeon was the obvious place to look at. It's actually been remarkably... there are remarkably few sort of deep dives into their company and the inner workings of Nickelodeon. So I picked a show called Ni Hao Kai Lan, which is teaching kids Mandarin Chinese, and it's a Chinese-American girl named Kai Lan. Ni Hao is hello, as we will all know next month during the Olympics. And they launched the show in February, but not before a four-year odyssey of getting it to the screen. It was a pretty arduous journey, but they've already greenlit a second season, and it seems to be doing fairly well.
One of the things that came to, as there's many surprises in this book, but one of the things that really surprised me was the marketing of these programs. You mentioned that Ni Hao was 4 years in the development stage, and then you have this development thing going on, but then you've got to have a rollout. Tell us about what was planned for the rollout of the revival of the electric company.
Well, that's a very interesting case because it's, you know, this is a property that many people know. I mean, I grew up on the electric company. I'm sure, you know, a lot of your listeners can relate to that. And it's, you know, it's a household name. And they decided to bring it back, but they didn't want to do it in a way that was kind of out of step with the times. So they developed it first, and it's actually just about to hit the web. They're going to make it an internet series of shorts, and that's where it's going to live initially. And they figured that's the way to sort of get the word out, and the way people pass videos around and email them to friends and whatever and share them, that's the way it will sort of grow and be sort of incubated before it actually becomes a full-blown TV show. So it's a real nod to the digital era and to the way a lot of shows happen now. Actually, Ni Hao Kailan, which is the show at Nickelodeon that I followed, never was intended initially as a full-blown series. They made three shorts and put them on the website, Nick.com, and they got incredible traffic, and people responded very favorably to them, and they decided, well, you know, why not make a series out of this? Mm. So that's kind of what's going on in a lot of places. But, yeah, Electric Company is a really interesting case where they're going out of their way to make it germane to kids who, you know, increasingly are living on the Internet.
Yeah. Now, when you were writing the book, they were going to debut the revival in short episodes meant to be seen on a cell phone.
Yes, there's also, right, that's another component. Those same episodes I should have mentioned are also going to be served through different cell phone carriers. I'm not sure which one it is, but it's a lot of the, you know, the big name telecom providers. So, you know, that's another thing that's happening now is, like, they call them mobisodes, where it's actually on your mobile device, and there's something that they actually call passback technology, where the idea is that you want to make it something that an adult can load up onto the cell phone and then pass back to the back seat, mm-hmm. to a kid in a car seat, and you know, that's what everybody's developing. Nowadays.
I wonder what percent of children under the age of 3 know how to operate a cell phone.
Well, there aren't cell phones made for under 3-year-olds, and you can imagine why there aren't, but it gets pretty close to that. Anecdotally, I will say I know a lot of, you know, my friends, and it's happened in my household, the cell phone tends to be a pretty attractive toy for a little ones.
Sure.
Running around. It's you know, and you can see in a toy store there are a lot of replica, yeah, cell phones that are made, and they tend to be pretty popular as well.
Boy, I feel ancient. In my day, it was car keys, kid.
Right, you know? Right.
Dade Hayes is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He is a journalist. His beat is the entertainment business. He is the author, most recently, of Anytime Playdate, Inside the Preschool Entertainment Boom, or How Television Became My Baby's Best Friend. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. We'd love to hear from you. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, if you'd like to join us, give us a call, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. So tell us what the inspiration was for the title of the book, Anytime Playdate.
Well, it's an interesting story. It was the heading of a flyer that fell out of a Barney DVD that I opened. Sometimes they'll stick these little coupons or promotional bits of paper inside a DVD, and it just sort of fell to the floor, and it said, "Your child is invited to an anytime play date," and it was promoting this cable network called PBS Kids Sprout, which is a 24-hour channel. The gist of it was basically, your child can plug in, 24/7 to this network and have a play date, And I was just so struck by that phrase and by the notion of ubiquity, because that is one thing that has really changed. I mean, you can trace an arc, and I do go back to the very early days of Howdy Doody and the shows that kind of started it all. And there's an interesting connective tissue between some of the modern shows and those earlier shows. But one thing that has absolutely changed that you can point to in the last few years is the portability and the idea that there are screens everywhere now, that there are screens in the minivan, that built into the back of the seats. There are portable DVD players, there are iPods. And there's an idea that you can have an anytime play date, that basically, whenever the mood strikes, it's there. And that's something also that parents have to contend with, because it's just this constant idea that, it's not like the TV is going to only be playing the appropriate thing at 8 in the morning or 5 o'clock in the evening, the way that it used to be. So it's created some more headaches, and I just thought it was a perfect kind of encapsulation of this whole sort of space and the state of things.
Yeah. Well, part of me thinks that 24/7 is okay for adults, and part of me thinks it's insane for adults. All of me thinks 24/7 for kids is absolutely nuts.
Well, I'm conflicted on this, I have to admit, because I certainly grant that point, that it just seems like over the edge somehow. It just seems like why does it need to be sort of injected into, why does entertainment have to kind of fill in all these nooks and crannies that, used to be kind of just the province of a child's imagination or internal life, But there's an interesting, there is on the flip side a power to being able to control entertainment. And I think you see that now more and more with the way the internet overall just culturally is affecting everything from the presidential race to the way broadcast networks program their lineups. And I think people are starting to, we're early on into this whole revolution, but there is a way for parents to kind of harness the 24/7 factor and use it for the good, because the boom in content for preschoolers is a little disorienting. I begin the book on my living room floor with just this vast array of products that I kind of can't make sense of. And like a lot of parents, I'm just sort of looking for answers. But the one thing that technology does allow you to do is, program your DVR so you're actually capturing the shows that you prefer for your parent, for your child to see, and kind of introducing this notion of filtering. I mean, that can be a powerful lesson, if you subscribe to, the idea of media literacy and raising kids who know that it's not just about the TV being on or off, but it's about discernment and, being able to kind of find the good stuff. I mean, that can be a very important lesson if you accept the fact that we're in the 21st century and, they're not going to be making any less TV or web content, as these children come of age.
Is more better.
I mean, that is sort of the flip side. I mean, I went through the same I mean, in a way, the book stubbornly refuses to kind of come down on one side or another, because mm-hmm. I feel like there have been so many polemics about this subject, and people have written so they've written these prescriptions and kind of tried to add to the load of guilt that parents feel about how they're raising their kids. And I was really trying to be a little more even-handed, and so I can really relate to what you're saying, that it just seems a little scary. But I've also come around to the point of view that if you just get involved with it and reckon with the amount of content that's out there, you know, the fact that we have this technology, you know, can do some good things. I'm glad I can actually find a Pixar movie, put it in the DVD player, and bring it on a drive with my daughter. You know, that's something that I couldn't have done, 10 years ago.
In the course of researching and writing the book, what did you hear from parents about the issues you were investigating?
Well, it was interesting. It was a wide spectrum of conviction. You know, it's almost, you know, I don't want to make facile comparisons, but it does have like these, you know, deep-seated feelings attached to it, you know, the way religion does almost. It's really a pretty deep issue. I mean, parents are just either, I mean, it's not either or, but I would say that many parents have been, you know, have reacted to me as I was explaining what I was working on by just saying, you know, we don't let our children watch any TV, you know, and they're the extremists on that side. And then, you know, on the other end of it, you have seemingly, you know, no controls on certain kids where they sort of watch. I mean, what alarms me is that there's a tremendous blurring of the line, as you've seen these kind of tween shows like Hannah Montana or High School Musical. You know, those have really been on the rise. And you get 3-, 4-, 5-year-old kids watching that, which I really have to draw the line at. And I think that's a big mistake, is not making it age appropriate. So you kind of get all different things. I mean, you know, but the other thing is, we are also the first generation, you know, raised on TV, who's also then, you know, raising children. So there's, you know, with television. So there's kind of, you know, as extreme as the points of view might have been, there's also kind of a general acknowledgement that we all, you know, came of age with Sesame Street and with Mr. Rogers, and, you know, the sort of dawn of educational television, which made it interesting.
Yeah. Did you hear concerns about how quickly the world seems to want kids to grow up?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I as I stepped back and tried to put, you know, children's media in a broader context, it was just impossible not to see it as just symptomatic of this larger urge to, you know, have kids grow up more quickly. I mean, it's amazing if you think about fashion and all these labels like Armani and, you know, all the rest. They all make clothes for toddlers and sometimes even babies. There are gourmet food shops that are designed for preschoolers. There's so many ways that we just seem to want to accelerate this whole process. I mean, you know, forget about the labels. Even just looking at, you know, just the way clothes are designed, and these kind of flared pants and, you know, short skirts and, you know, the stuff for my daughter. I you know, some of it really is quite offensive. So, you know, there just seems to be a culturally this strange impatience and desire for, you know, and I still haven't quite, you know, arrived at a firm conclusion as to what's really driving it, except for just everything seems to be happening a little faster these days. And, you know, that's something that I found a lot in the reading that I did. I mean, Neil Postman, you know, The Disappearance of Childhood was a really powerful book that I uncovered, and you know, I think he was way ahead of his time. I mean, he was writing 20 years ago, but the themes really still resonate.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about him yesterday on the show. We had a guest with us who co-authored a book with Postman, How to Watch TV News. And, of course, Postman probably best known for amusing ourselves to death.
Yes, I mean, it's so impressive to really take stock of his career when you consider he was so perceptive about media. And that's how I came to his work, and maybe I think, you know, the majority of people do. But then he wrote exhaustively about education and child development and all of those areas. So for me, you know, wanting to explore both or sort of, you know, combine both, I mean, the Disappearance of Childhood is a really powerful text. I would just urge people to read it because I think it just in a very lucid way lays out the development of, humankind over the last several hundred years in a way that just, I still can't stop thinking about it.
Yeah. A couple of related questions now. People in the business, how do they see this world? How do they answer concerns and criticisms from parents and others who are concerned about the development and well-being of children, someone like a Neil Postman?
Well, what's interesting, what I discovered when I started digging into this and kind of trying to go behind the scenes of the business and find out who's actually producing this stuff, is that it is pretty noteworthy to look at the credentials of the people who are doing this stuff. I mean, they, by and large, have some kind of training in, you know, child psychology, child development, education theory. It's hard to generalize, but by and large, they're fairly cognizant of the pitfalls and the things that they're trying not to teach. But what you have to remember is that they're, you know, the creation of a television show is a very, it's a self-selecting group, and it's a group of people who are just trying to band together to make the very best TV show that they can. Now, the exploitation of that show is a whole other set of people, and once you get into theme park rides and video games and collectibles and toys, I mean, you're kind of in a whole other realm. So, but what I did find was that there was a remarkable degree of sensitivity. They test these shows rather exhaustively. I have a couple of scenes in the book where I talk about these focus groups. Usually that is a kind of, disconcerting phrase. It's sort of like an ominous phrase, focus group. It sounds like, somebody's, testing some pernicious, food product or something. But actually, there is a more hopeful connotation here because they're focus grouping this stuff because they want to make sure that it actually connects with kids. And I did find time and time again that they were taking the feedback from kids and digesting it and trying to improve the scripts and improve the animation so that it would, it would be able to be of a higher caliber. And I mean, the best examples of that were several shows that Sesame Street tested and found that they were troubling kids too much, whether it was an episode trying to teach nonviolent conflict resolution or about how to cope with parents' divorce. There are a lot of important issues out there for kids, and to their credit, they were trying to take those on. But then after testing, they just found that kids were too stressed out by it. Same thing with Dora the Explorer, the Swiper character, which is this, slightly malevolent fox. He began as a much more intense villain. He had sharper teeth. He was a little more of a bad seed, and they just found that the early tests that they did, just kids were a bit too freaked out. So they kind of had to keep toning him down. So, I mean, it's hard to say too much more than that, but I wouldn't say that there's a bunch of people, you know, cooking up a big scheme in some back room. You know, I mean, it's a group of fairly responsive, you know, well-informed professionals. Some, you know, many of them are parents themselves. You know, so whatever the bigger criticisms might be, I was having a hard time pinning those criticisms on any of the people I encountered.
Hmm. Now, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends against TV viewing for children under the age of 2. Why that recommendation, and how aware are parents of that recommendation?
Well, you know, it's amazing how few are aware. They did a survey, the Kaiser Family Foundation, as part of their major survey in 2006. They asked parents, whether they were aware of this recommendation, and only 6% said that they had heard of it, which is remarkable. And a further study that was published in Pediatrics helps explain why. You know, they were asking pediatricians if they actually engaged their patients on the issues of media and its effects. And the result was kind of shocking. I don't have the figure right here in front of me, but it was about half the pediatricians, maybe even less than half, said that they ever spoke about media with their patients. And you know, compare that to other sort of environmental issues at home, whether it's smoking or,
diet.
Just any diet, exactly,
exercise.
Nutrition, exercise. I mean, there's certain basic things that, you know, any pediatrician is going to want to, you know, be aware of, you know, things that are going on in the home. And to me, it's not a big stretch to actually add some discussion of media to that. But in my experience, I can't say that any pediatrician has ever inquired about that. So it's just we're early enough into this boom where, you know, and I know pediatricians have a tough time for all the various reasons that many doctors do, with the, you know, the insurance situation being what it is, and, you know, the amount of time they have per visit. You know, they've got to pack a lot into a checkup. So, you know, I'm not condemning them necessarily, but I'm just saying that's actually an important place where a lot of teaching or investigation can occur, where it isn't. And, you know, you asked about the recommendation in general. I mean, I spoke to a couple of pediatricians, including one of the architects of the recommendation. And, you know, he admitted that it was sort of, a best guess. It was sort of better safe than sorry type of recommendation, where they were just basing it on information they had about brain development and on the supposition that, you know, television time might take up space that should be occupied by just, you know, organic brain development that would occur a certain other way if television were not involved.
First, do no harm.
Yeah, so, but they don't have any hard evidence that they were basing it on. They were not saying, based on such and such a study, you know, we're imposing this recommendation. It was sort of, it's come under some criticism. It's been on the books for, you know, the better part of a decade now, but it's not unassailable. I mean, there are plenty of very reasonable, well-credentialed academics and others who question it.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, journalist Dade Hayes, author of Anytime Playdate, Inside the Preschool Entertainment Boom, or How Television Became My Baby's Best Friend. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Join the conversation with the telephone call. We've got a listener waiting to talk with us in Paxton on line 4. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you so much for the show. I'm really enjoying it and can't wait to read the book. I just have a question. You were talking about the development of shows with kind of educational content and how they integrated research with kids into the shows and tested the shows with kids and then adapted them. I'm wondering how that compares with shows that are more strictly for entertainment. So perhaps shows like SpongeBob or something that is on the Cartoon Network that doesn't necessarily have that educational content embedded in it.
Sure. Well, thanks very much for your question. I would have to say it's very exhaustive testing that occurs on every level when you're a big network like Nickelodeon. So a show like SpongeBob or over at Cartoon Network, some of their stuff, I mean, it still goes before a lot of kids and gets, you know, put through the wash, if you will. One interesting distinction on the preschool level is they also test on parents. They have focus groups that are strictly parents, where they're also gauging the reaction of parents who, you know, after all, are often the decision makers in the household when it comes to media. But in terms of, you know, I think more specifically, you were just wondering, you know, what is different about the testing? And I just think on a level of SpongeBob, it's going to be much more about, you know, does the dialogue work? Is there a confusion because of the way something is animated? You know, does the story connect with viewers? But that's a lot different from a show that's trying to teach emotional intelligence or, you know, pre-literacy or math. I mean, you're talking about concepts where if one scene is out of whack, the entire educational goal of the show kind of goes out the window. And so what happens at the preschool level is they can tackle the educational stuff, and often the entertainment quotient is detectable throughout the test. So they have attention scores where they're looking at how closely kids are watching the screen every minute. They mark every minute of the, you know, 22-minute episode. So they're monitoring that, but they're also really trying to make sure that the educational component is getting across.
Does a listener want to follow up?
No, that's great. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
Okay,
thanks for the call this afternoon. We have just a couple minutes left here in this portion of the program. If you'd like to talk with Jade Hayes, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. It was interesting. Last weekend, my husband and I went to see the new Pixar movie, WALL-E, and there were a lot of small children in the audience. And really, the movie is not for kids. It was interesting to see how quickly they lost interest in it. But the short, they loved it because it was so entertaining. It was all slapstick, is what it was, essentially.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen it. It's a thing about a magician and his rabbit.
You know, I didn't end up seeing the short, but I know about it.
Yeah,
I've seen the film, but didn't see the short. So, but you're actually asking about a very interesting phenomenon, and it's not brand new. You know, if you think about some of the great allegorical, you know, texts, one of the, I think, more prominent ones might be Animal Farm. You know, where you can read it, you know, when you're 7, 17, eight, you know, 87, and get like totally different layers of meaning. And that's why it's such a successful work. But I think Pixar is operating at a similar level where they're able to engage all different ages and sort of walks of life. I mean, I have heard that same observation, and it's stayed with me about WALL-E because it's a really rich text for adults. And as squirmy as little kids might get, you know, from my point of view, I feel like it's good that they're at least getting some notion of that, you know, the larger themes, even if they don't really, they may not be totally conscious of it, but,
yeah.
You know.
Let's take one more call before we run out of time. A listener in Urbana, line one, hi.
Hi. I know you touched on this a little bit earlier, but I was hoping you might follow up on your thoughts about the combination of educational TV for preschoolers with this commercial aspect. I know in Sweden, commercial commercial not allowed on TV. I'm not sure if you're familiar with their system, but I'm wondering, since you said you have a child, if you have any opinions about how this combination of education with the commercial aspects, like you were talking about theme parks and the marketing of different products, might be affecting the experiences that our youth are having with this medium. And I'll keep this offline. Thanks.
Okay.
Well, it is kind of the main theme of the book, I would say. And I guess I feel that we're in a very interesting place because, you know, I have a whole chapter about toys. And my editor was saying, you know, why do we need a chapter on toys? And I said, well, you should really take a walk down the toy aisle. And I mean, the amazing thing is you can't buy a toy these days almost that doesn't have some connection to a TV show or a movie. And that's a little depressing, honestly. I mean, there's some good work being done, you know, as far as, you know, theme toys, but it's all a bit shallow to me that it all has to kind of connect up and you don't get anything like Lincoln Logs or, you know, the kind of classic toys that didn't have anything to do with anything, you know. So as far as those commercial interests, I mean, it's a consumer marketplace that we're in. It's not, you know, PBS, I think, is fighting the good fight in many respects, trying to just put things on the air that have good content. But they're also having to merchandise like crazy. I mean, Sesame Workshop, you know, makes a couple $100 million a year by putting Elmo on, you know, packages of diapers and everywhere else. You know, and they say that they have to do that in order to fund the educational outreach. So it is kind of this Mobius strip where it's like one always kind of coexists with the other. And it's true around the world, by the way. I mean, the UK, which has been home to so many great kids shows over the years, you know, they're in a battle right now as far as the commercial interests versus the just pure entertainment aspects. So, you know, it's not just our culture that's engaged in this kind of dialectic.
Yeah. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Dade Hayes, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Dade Hayes is the author of Anytime Playdate, Inside the Preschool Entertainment Boom, or How Television Became My Baby's Best Friend. Anytime Playdate is published by the Free Press.
You're listening to an archive edition of the Afternoon Magazine with your host, Celeste Quinn. I'm Todd Gleason with AM 580 Agriculture. It's time to take a look at what's been happening in the world of the agricultural markets from Chicago and Kansas City and Minneapolis. We'll start in Chicago with the nearby wheat futures finished like this on a Monday afternoon. The December contract with a high of 715 and a three quarters, a low at 666, settlement price at $6.68, 48 cents the loss. March futures 738 the high, the low at 687 and a half, settlement price at 689, down 48. And the May futures 750 the high, the low at $7.35, settled on that low, down 47 and a half cents. July 758 the high, the low at 14. Settlement price for July, this is next year's wheat crop, 716, down 45.5 cents from the Minneapolis Grain Exchange. Nearby December spring wheat settled 43 lower at 746 and three quarters, and Kansas City hard red winter wheat was down 40 and three quarters on the afternoon at $7 and a nickel. From the corn pit, the losses stacking up and finished limit down across the grains floor in the corn pit. December contract, a 542 and a quarter top, bottom at 513, settled there, down 30 cents. March futures 560 the high, the low in the settlement price both 30 lower at 531, and May futures in the corn pit 572 the high, the low in the settlement at 542 and a half, down the 30 cent limit. July futures 581 and a half, the high and the low in settlement price at 552 and a half, finished 30 lower, and September corn 575 and a half, the high, the low in the limit move lower at 556.5, down 30 cents. December futures for next year, a 587.5 top, the bottom and settlement price at $5.58 and three quarters, once again, down that 30-cent limit. And next year's December, rather 2010 December corn crop, 581 the high, the low at 550 and three quarters, the settlement there down the 30-cent limit at 550 and three quarters. That also the low for the day, as it is the limit moved down. December oat futures, a 330.5, top, bottom at 313.5, a settlement price at 318, down 13 and a quarter. And the March contract, 343.25, the high, the low at 333.25. Settlement price at 335.25, down 13.75. Soybean pit finished the day, limit lower. That all coming after Congress failed to approve the bailout plan that Mr. Paulson had asked for, but that came later in the day. There was weakness all day long in Chicago. November beans were down the limit early, I believe, and then bounced back a bit. Managed to finish the limit lower, $11.60.5, the high. The low at 11, or rather at $10.94, settled on that low, $10.94 for November soybeans, down 70 cents this afternoon. January futures, $11.78, the high, the low at $11.10.5, a settlement price at $11.10.5, down 70 cents. March contract, $11.87.75, the high, the low at $11.24.25, settled on that low, down the limit, 70 lower. And May futures, $11.90.25, the high, the low at $11.37, settled there, down 70 cents. July futures, $12.12.25, the high, the low, and the settlement price, both at $11.47.25, down 70. And August soybeans, $11.95.5, the high, the low at $11.46. That was also the settlement price, down 70 cents. November beans for 2009, $11.68.25, the high, the low in the settlement, like the rest of the pit, down 70 cents, finished at $11.09.5 for the November 2009 soybeans. Just to take a check out, November 2010 soybeans settled at $11.05.5. That was down the limit. The high price at $11.17 for the November 2010 soybean contract. October bean meal futures, $3.15 the high, the low at $2.94.70. Settlement price at $2.95.70, down $19.30. December, $320.80 the high, the low at $300.70. December bean meal settled at $301.40, down $19.30. October bean oil futures, $47.83 the high, low at $44.49, settlement price at $44.70, down $2.70. And December, $47.96, the high, the low at $45.43, settled on that low at $45.43. December bean oil off $2.50 for the afternoon. During the closing mark report this afternoon, comes up in just about 8 minutes now, we'll talk with Kurt Kimmel. He's the senior grains analyst at Bates Commodities in Normal, Illinois. The numbers from the Mercantile Exchange in just a moment.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Chicago Mercantile Exchange, livestock side today. CME Group, October live cattle, a 290 loss today. $100 even was the high, the low at $98. Settlement price at $98 and a nickel, down $2.90 for the October live cattle futures. December at 101.70 on its top, the bottom at 99.80, settled at 99.87.5, down 292.5. And February, 101.75, the high, the low at $100.07.5, settlement price at $100.10. Down $2.97.5. April futures were down $3 today. 102 the high, the low at $100.27.5. Settled on that low, down $3. October feeder cattle down the limit, 104.80 the high, the low at 102.80. Settlement price on that low, down $3. November, 104 and a nickel the high, the low in the settlement, down the $3 limit at 102.57.5. And the January feeders at 104.52.5 top, the bottom in the settlement price, down the $3 limit at $102.80 for the January feeder cattle. March feeder cattle's feeder cattle at 102.80 as well. They were down $3 and had a high price today at 104.90. October lean hog futures on the afternoon, 69.25 the high, the low at 68.50. Settlement price at 68.55, down $1.07.5. December, 65.35 the high, low at 64.50. Settlement price at $65 and a nickel, down a dollar. February, 71.30 the high, the low at 70.57.5, and a settlement price at 71.20, down 65. It's 2 o'clock Central Time.